The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight, with Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Welcome to a Friday. We've made it to the end of the week. I got to tell you, I'm Nicole Sandler here at NicoleSandler.com, of course, on the Progressive Voices Network and Netroots Radio, FYI Nation, and a lot of other stations that carry us. Thanks to all that do. And thank you for listening however you choose to listen, whether it's live or via one of our wonderful affiliates or the podcast, which is always free. But, you know, we operate on the public radio model of voluntary donations. Our work is 100% listener funded. So your donations are not only welcomed but and truly appreciated, but necessary. Yesterday turned out to be a fun show. I told you I was a bit stuck at the beginning of the show, not really sure which way to go. And we wound up getting a bunch of phone calls, which was always welcome. I love taking phone calls. It's difficult doing a show like this. Again, as I explained yesterday, it was easier when I was live on the Progressive Voices Network because it's a wider audience listening live, so it's easier to get the call-ins. So when you do call in, I truly appreciate it. Although I got to caution you, because I took one call yesterday, and I'm not going to embarrass the person who it was because that doesn't even really matter. The point is, you got to beware of fake news. This person called in to talk a bit about James Comey, who we were talking about. And when I asked, you know, what his problems were with Comey, one of the things he brought up was Whitey Bulger. And I didn't comment then because I wasn't sure what he was talking about. You know, I do my best to stay well-versed on a wide variety of topics, but obviously I can't know everything. And I hadn't heard of a Jim Comey case having to do with Whitey Bulger. Well, there's a good reason, because that story emanated from Fox. It's fake news. Jim Comey never worked at the FBI office in Boston, and he never worked on the Whitey Bulger case. In fact, I just happened to stumble on a segment last night on CNN with Anderson Cooper where he was debunking this very story. So one of our friends here got taken in. So I thought I would share with you, by way of a public service announcement from Jimmy Kimmel, a little bit of a primer, if you will, on fake news.
President Trump needs to be confused about what is and isn't fake news. So to help out, because we are all about helping out here at this show, we asked the third grader. That's right. We asked a local third grader named Noah to break it down for the president in a very simple way.
And us. Here we go.
Hi, Mr. President. Today I'm going to explain fake news, because it's not what you think it is. So what is it?
Well, the dictionary defines fake as a thing that is not genuine, a forgery or sham. So, fake news is a news story that is intentionally fabricated and presented as if it were real news. Get it? For example, this headline was widely shared on Facebook. Cinnamon roll can explodes inside man's butt during shoplifting incident.
Uh-oh.
That's funny, but it's fake. And even though it's fake, this article was shared 765,000 times.
Ouch.
That's a lot of times. Unfortunately, a lot of the fake news articles misled people about important subjects, like reporting that the Pope endorsed you. Or that ISIS told Muslims to vote for Hillary. That's fake news. But this, don't let the fake news tell you that there's big infighting in the Trump admin. We are getting along great and getting major things done. It's not fake news, Mr. President. It's real news that you disagree with. And that's an important difference, because when you call real news fake, you undermine people's trust in the free press to keep us informed. Thanks for listening. And let me know if you have any questions.
Okay, so get it? Now, the story about... the story about Whitey Bulger and James Comey letting Whitey Bulger go or covering for him or whatever it was, that's fake news. And it was made up by the people at Fox. And there was a whole graphic that Anderson Cooper showed of Sean Hannity with his arrows from James Comey to Whitey Bulger and all these other people in there as well. Fake. Totally fake. Made up stuff. Not true at all. Again, lots of reasons to dislike James Comey. I've got a few of them, but that's not one of them. Okay? All right. We got a good show for you today. You know, I was just listening to Tom Hartman as I was prepping for today's show, and somebody called in talking about a candidate who's running for Congress, and they wanted to get him on, him or her on the show. And Tom Hartman said, well, we wait till after the primaries. I don't put on anyone before the primaries are over. Unless they're so far out in front, it's, you know, it's a no-brainer that they're going to win. Wow. I totally disagree with that. You see, primaries matter. This is my mantra these days. This is the most important part of the election season. If you're concerned with getting real progressives elected to Congress, and I think that's what you and I are concerned about, right? So today we will have a couple of candidates on the show, one from North Carolina and one from Indiana, because those are the next primaries that are coming up on May 8th. And these are two really good progressive candidates. Frankly, I have no idea where they are in the polls. Maybe they can tell us. I do know that they are Blue America PAC endorsed candidates. In other words, they have Howie Klein's seal of approval, meaning that they'd be great additions, progressive members of Congress, which is what we need, not the type of right-wing dreck that the DCCC is trying to foist upon us. Primary seasons matter. This is the time when we should have candidates on. I'm not saying as we get closer that I wouldn't put someone who's going to be on the ballot in November on the program. Because it's important that at that point that we elect Democrats. But right now, the goal has to be getting progressives to win the primaries. So today, a couple of real progressives will join us. But first, let's start the way we always do and take a look at what's news. And yes, we're going to do it live.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The Justice Department last night gave Congress, turned over to Congress, who then in turn leaked to the media, the memos written by former FBI Director James Comey documenting his interactions with the president. Comey had explained that he kept contemporaneous notes because he feared the president would later lie about their meetings.
The memos are out and they almost read like unedited pages from Comey's book, providing a glimpse into how Comey interacted with the president despite the so-called cloud of the Russia investigation hanging over them. Discussions of loyalty, former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, and just a clear sense that those salacious rumors about Trump's visit to Moscow in 2013 really got under his skin, at least according to Comey. Now, in one of the unclassified memos, it includes this now famous conversation where Trump allegedly told Comey, quote, I hope you can see your way clear to letting this go, to letting Flynn go. But there's also new information, including a claim that President Trump told Comey at a dinner at the White House back in January of 2017 that he had, quote, serious reservations about Mike Flynn's judgment, and that former chief of staff Reince Priebus actually asked Comey if Flynn was under surveillance just days before Flynn was fired. Now, almost immediately, lawmakers jumped jumped on this news with Democrats like Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi tweeting that the release of these Comey memos are just further proof of Trump's contempt for the rule of law. But Republicans say the memos are more indicative of what they don't say. And they actually prove that former Director Comey never felt obstructed and that he never wrote that he felt threatened.
Rachel Maddow spoke with Comey on MSNBC about the memos shortly after they were released last night. I guess, you know, I was thinking, wow, she didn't do so great on the bookings. So many other outlets got him before she did, but she lucked out in the timing, in the timing sweepstakes, because Comey appeared with her just after these memos were released, and they got to talk about the really salacious parts.
I want to ask you about one other statement that the president reportedly made to you that's in these memos that have just been released tonight. This is in your words. The president brought up the golden showers thing and said it really bothered him if his wife had any doubt about it. He then explained, as he did at our dinner, that he hadn't stayed overnight in Russia during the Miss Universe trip. Twice during this part of the conversation, Reince Priebus tried to interject a comment about the redacted and why it was even in there, but the president ignored him. The president said the hookers thing is nonsense, but that Putin had told him, "We have some of the most beautiful hookers in the world." He did not say when Putin had told him this, and I don't recall, redacted. Some of this is redacted. The president was conveying this to you at the White House.
In the Oval Office.
And he told you that he'd had a personal conversation with President Putin about hookers?
Yes.
Which they now deny.
Did you believe him, or did you think he was speaking hyperbolically?
Didn't seem to be speaking hyperbolically.
Do we otherwise know that the president had had personal conversations with Vladimir Putin at that point?
I can't recall. I think there was public reporting that he had spoken to Vladimir Putin as sort of a welcome, you know, congratulations on taking office thing at that point. I'm not suggesting they talked about how beautiful the hookers were in Russia, but I do know there was at least one publicly reported conversation.
That would be an unusual first call between new heads of state, the congratulatory phone call to be bragging about the relative value of each country's hookers would be an unusual.
I think that's a fair statement.
I think so, too.
Yeah, think. You know, Trump has had trouble finding lawyers to represent him. Well, no longer. He's got a few new ones, including Rudy Giuliani. I'm not kidding.
The president's legal team is making a big play. They are bringing in former New York City mayor and one-time Republican presidential candidate Rudy Giuliani. Before he was mayor, Giuliani made a name for himself as, let's call it, a very aggressive U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, the same office that ordered the FBI raid on Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen. Giuliani has links to the two key people in this investigation, the fired FBI Director James Comey. He worked under Giuliani in the Southern District. And Special Counsel Robert Mueller was, you'll recall, director of the FBI during and after 9/11 when Giuliani was New York mayor. The Giuliani hire comes as the president has escalated his attacks on Mueller. Tonight, Giuliani told the Washington Post, quote, "I hope we can negotiate an end to this for the good of the country and because I have high regard for the president and for Bob Mueller." Giuliani did not say whether a final decision has been made on a potential Trump-Mueller sit-down interview. That may be determined by the strength of Giuliani's personal connection to Trump. In addition to Giuliani, Trump has hired the husband and wife legal team of Jane Serene Raskin and Marty Raskin, former federal prosecutors, both of whom with experience in organized crime cases, who run a Florida-based law firm. All three of these new legal additions will be working with Jay Sekulow and White House lawyer Ty Cobb.
It should be interesting. To be continued. Students from more than 2,500 schools across the country streamed out of class today as part of a national school walkout to demand action on gun reform. The event, held on April 20th, also marks the anniversary of the 1999 Columbine High School massacre in Colorado, where a gunman killed 12 students and a teacher. The walkout started at 10 a.m. in each time zone, as they did last month. Students will leave their classrooms and observe a moment of silence for shooting victims. Other actions during the day include marching to local lawmakers' offices, allowing open mic time for students to share concerns, and helping register those who are eligible to vote. Here's breaking news, just happened a couple of hours ago. The Democratic National Committee today filed a multi-million dollar lawsuit accusing the Trump campaign of colluding with WikiLeaks and the Russian government to interfere in the 2016 presidential election. The Washington Post reporting that the lawsuit, which was filed in a federal district court in Manhattan, claims that Trump's campaign encouraged Russia to illegally hack the emails of the Democrats while also conspiring to help Russian agents spread and disseminate the leaked documents, leaked communications. The lawsuit does not name Trump as a defendant. Instead, it names people within the Trump campaign who were known to have had contacts with Russian officials who promised them dirt on Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton, such as Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort, and George Papadopoulos. And finally, today is 420. You know what that means. So there is some 420 news. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer announced today that he'll be introducing legislation to decriminalize marijuana at the federal level, removing it from the Controlled Substances Act, the first time that a leader of either party in Congress has endorsed a rollback of one of the country's oldest drug laws. And that's a bit of what's news for now. As I said, we've got a couple of great progressive candidates coming up today. So we'll take a break. We'll check in with Brad and Desi in the Green News Report and come back with Jenny Marshall of North Carolina, who is running in, I believe it's North Carolina's 5th Congressional District. The primary is coming up May 8th. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
1.5 million clients from the Puerto Rico Power Authority in the dark.
Puerto Rico's fragile electric grid hit by another island-wide blackout.
We have to expect, unfortunately, a further slowdown of this important ocean circulation system.
New studies warn the Gulf Stream current is slowing down. Earth Day 2018 is focused on ending plastic pollution. Plus,
the companies that knowingly caused this crisis should help pay their fair share.
Oil industry slapped with two new climate liability lawsuits.
All of those slaps and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Trump canceled his trip to monitor events in Syria. Sarah Huckersanders explained that Trump's national security team thought it was best to stay in the United States, adding Mar-a-Lago happens to be with in the United States. But thanks to global warming, it'll soon be in international waters.
This is your Green News Report.
Global warming fans, all right. If you can't fight it, get used to it. Now,
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, just more bad news for Puerto Rico.
Yes, indeed. 7 months after Hurricane Maria, the entire island of Puerto Rico lost power again on Wednesday. According to the San Juan El Nuevo Dia newspaper, the outage was caused by a private Oklahoma contractor, Cobra Energy, accidentally hitting a major transmission line, creating a domino effect that tripped two power plants offline.
So we are 7 months now since Hurricane Maria.
Yep.
And even before all the power went down on Wednesday, some 44,000 were still without power after all of those months.
Yes, and that same contractor is linked to a different power outage that occurred just last week. It is another reminder that while nearly all of the island's generation capacity is back online, its grid remains fragile and unstable. It's the worst blackout in American history, and this week it officially became the second longest blackout in world history. And the 2018 hurricane season starts in 6 weeks.
But don't forget, Donald Trump gave himself an A-plus for his response to that hurricane.
As far as Puerto Rico is concerned, we have had tremendous reviews. We're doing a great job. Everybody has said it's amazing the job that we've done in Puerto Rico. We are going to
do far
more than anybody else would ever be able to do.
Meanwhile, two new studies indicate that the Gulf Stream current in the Atlantic Ocean, which helps regulate the global climate, is slowing down, and that global warming is probably to blame. A full shutdown of the Gulf Stream was depicted in the 2004 disaster movie The Day After Tomorrow, but the scientists stressed that that extreme movie scenario will never happen. But lead study author Stefan Romsdorf of the Potsdam Climate Institute warns that it could still have potentially severe long-term consequences for people living on both sides of the Atlantic.
For example, this slowdown leads to excessive sea level rise on the east coast of the United States, It changes the tracks of the storms moving into Europe, and it has even been linked to extreme heat waves in Europe.
Meanwhile, two new climate liability lawsuits this week. Eight Florida teens sued Republican Governor Rick Scott to force the state to act on climate change. Backed by nonprofit environmental law group Our Children's Trust, the suit cites the threat of rising seas and other climate impacts to Florida's coast and economy, and contends that the state's failure to act violates the children's constitutional rights to a safe and livable climate.
A lot of these suits now being filed all across the country and even across the world. It'll be very interesting to see how these play out here in the U.S.
And that's not all. In Colorado, three cities and two counties, led by the city of Boulder, filed suit against two of the world's largest oil companies, ExxonMobil and Suncor, over their role in causing climate change. The suit alleges that the oil companies, quote, knowingly produced harmful products and failed to disclose that to the public. It's the first climate liability lawsuit to be filed by communities that are not located on the coast. In a press conference, Boulder Mayor Suzanne Jones said they're seeking damages for record wildfires, record floods, and the cost of adapting to future impacts.
We think that the companies that knowingly caused this crisis should help pay their fair share, especially because they profited enormously from the crisis that they have created.
And these cases as well will be interesting to watch. I know that the oil companies are watching them very closely. They're very worried about it, and as far as I can tell, they should be.
Finally, Sunday marks the 48th annual Earth Day, with events scheduled all over the world to mobilize political action and engagement to protect the one and only planet able to support life in the known universe. This year's theme is ending plastic pollution, including the launch of a global effort to eliminate single-use plastics. Of course, for us here at the Green News Report, every day is Earth Day.
It is indeed. One day a year. That's for sissies. For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us, follow us, and share us earthwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
We're going to save the world tonight.
You're listening to The Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
All right, we are back. And as I mentioned before, today we're featuring a couple of great primary challengers in a couple of elections coming up in the next primary race, which is May 8th. First, we head out to North Carolina's 5th Congressional District to talk with Jenny Marshall. Hi, Jenny, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi, thank you so much for joining us today. I've been telling our listeners a little bit about you, and we're going to be speaking with Dan Cannon in a little while. I'm of the mind that primaries are so important because this is when we can really reach for the sky and get the best candidates into the general election. Do you find it hard when you're going around to get people excited during primary time, or do they all think that the big time comes in November?
Well, we do find that a lot of people are waiting till November, and it becomes especially difficult when you have a couple candidates from the same city. My primary opponent and I are both from Winston-Salem. We're both active in the political party. So we share a lot of the same acquaintances, friends, and Democratic friends. So we have found that people want to, like, wait until after the primaries and before they donate, before they volunteer. They don't want to seem like they're favoring one of us over the other. And then you have a group of people who just are not engaged with choosing who is going to go on to November. They're just like, I'll just wait till November, and whoever makes it through, that's who I'll vote for.
Wow. See, and that's the attitudes that I want to change. People need to be involved in the primary process, because this is when we can get a candidate like you to advance to the general election. So, Jenny Marshall, tell us a bit about yourself. Who are you, and why did you decide to run for Congress?
Well, I am a public school teacher, a wife, and a mom to 7 kids.
Wow.
Yeah, we have a large blended family. So I had 3, he had 2, and then we had 2 together.
Uh-huh.
And so I have been involved with my community. I've been a public school advocate and an advocate for the students that we serve for the past decade. And I was just really sick and tired of bringing the arguments for better public schools, for more economic equity, for a better environment to those people that have those positions of power, and decided to run for the seat held by the incumbent Virginia Fox, who sits on the Committee of Education and Workforce Development. We know that she has not invested in our community. She's ignored the people. Poverty is getting worse. Homelessness is getting worse. Upward mobility is getting worse, and we need a change.
Virginia Fox is one of the worst of the worst. She's just a truly horrendous member of Congress. So it is time to send her mm-hmm. packing. And she's vulnerable, isn't she?
Oh, absolutely. She just gave a talk to the Republicans in Wilkes County, which is one of our rural counties here in the 5th District, and basically said, the Democrats are coming for us. She rang the alarm bells and said that miracles can still happen because we got Donald Trump elected to the White House, and that they are doing God's work and they have the shared vision of values of America. Well, I hate to break it to you, Virginia, but our campaign is here, and we are here to unseat you because you do not hold the same values as the rest of America.
Let's talk.
We don't.
Go ahead. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about it.
I was just going to go on to say that, you know, we want to make sure that people have a living wage, and she mm-hmm. frankly does not care about that. We want to make sure that children have health insurance. She doesn't care about that. We want to make sure we protect the environment. She doesn't care about that.
No, she's lacking on all those issues and much more. She's just not a particularly pleasant person either. So Jenny Marshall, again, the website is marshallforhouse.org. We can find you on Twitter at Marshall4House. I want to talk about a few of the issues. And since you're a school teacher, let's start with education. Right now, we're looking at a situation around the country where in various states, it started in West Virginia, teachers are walking off the job. In Arizona, they just mm-hmm. voted for a walkout. I think it's happening this coming Thursday. What's it like in North Carolina? Are teachers being paid a living wage or is there a strike coming in North Carolina, too?
You know, teachers in North Carolina are overworked and underpaid. Our teacher pay has dropped from 19th in the country to 48 in less than a decade. The GOP assault on public education, we don't have textbooks. We don't have supplies. They are forcing schools to overcrowd their classrooms. Teachers are leaving by the droves, by the thousands and thousands. I had a great teacher, a friend of mine, leave the classroom within the past month because she was just burnt out. So we are using our professional staff up, and then we are throwing them away because we are not giving them the resources that they need. We're not giving them the ability to actually teach, and they lack autonomy in the classroom to make decisions that are best for their students. And frankly, we're just paying them a poverty wage.
That's horrible. And how's the governor on this issue?
I mean, Roy Cooper came in. He's a Democrat. He's starting to work for better pay for teachers, but with a supermajority Republican House and Senate at the state level, anything he wants to do, he has to get through them, and they're not having it. They love their charter schools. They love their voucher programs. They love the idea of privatization, virtual schools, anything to really undermine public education and really to perpetuate this dumbing down of America, because we're not able to do the job that we need to do in our public schools.
Right. It's really it's a travesty what's going on with regards to public education in our country. It's good to have school teachers who've been in the classroom who know what the challenges are. I think a lot of us, I mean, as a parent, I certainly do. And you're the parent to a lot of kids. You get it from both ends. So we've definitely got to do something about that. This Sunday is Earth Day, and we've seen our commitment to environmental causes go really down the tubes with the election of Donald Trump and the installation of Scott Pruitt as EPA administrator. What are your thoughts on the environment, on offshore drilling, which is something that the Trump administration wants to do? What do we do about our planet?
Well, as far as fossil fuels go, I say we need to keep them in the ground. We need to move to renewable green energy, which is going to be a boon for jobs, good paying jobs, jobs that are going to be around, because we know the fossil fuels are not a renewable source. There's a finite amount of them, and just because we find new ways of accessing fossil fuels does not mean they're good. And what I mean by that is fracking. In the 5th District, we have a couple frack zones. That's not a good way to harvest energy. It poisons water sources. It taints the land, and frankly, they do it in communities where they can't fight back. So we need to put more resources into the EPA. We need to give them their teeth back. We need to make sure that those companies that are poisoning our land, our water, our air, are held responsible, and that they, the corporation, and not the people who are paying their bills, so like, say, Duke Energy, which is our electric company here in North Carolina, that they're responsible for the cleanup, and they're not shifting that responsibility onto their consumers who are still trapped into buying their products.
So put an end to fracking?
Oh, yeah. We need to stop fracking. We need to move away from fossil fuels, and we need to start investing in green energy.
Great. Again, we're speaking with Jenny Marshall, who is running for Congress from North Carolina's 5th Congressional District. The primary is coming up on May 8th. And you said you only have one primary opponent. It's just two of you in the race?
Yeah, there's just two of us. And I'm actually sitting outside of our Forsyth County Board of Elections working the polls. This is the second day of early voting.
Oh.
So if you hear some ambient noise in the background, it's because I'm sitting outside right now. I'm taking a break from handing out literature to voters that are coming in to cast a ballot.
Great. Well,
that's
nice. There's a nice long early voting period. Some states don't have that luxury these days.
Yeah, well, we fought long and hard for that. We used to have it a little bit better. They've actually clamped down on the amount of early voting access that we have. So, like, here in Forsyth County, it's a county of about 400,000 people, and there's one place to vote. It's downtown, not the easiest place to get to nor to park in, and it's only open when the Board of Elections is open, so 8:30 to 5 o'clock, and then we're going to open up a couple other satellite locations and only one day of Saturday voting, and that's only for 3 hours.
Oh, no.
And that's kind of epidemic across the district. Most of the counties, there's 11 counties in the 5th District, and most of them have adopted a similar model, and that's because the Republicans have held control of the Board of Elections, and that's been a legal battle as well, because the governorship being Democrat, the Board of Elections should have gone into Democrats' hands with a majority Democrat, but that is not the case, so we're still fighting for access for people to actually be able to vote.
Have you always lived in North Carolina?
No, we moved here in 2012 for my husband. My husband got a job down here, but it's been great. It's been great. We love it in North Carolina. We used to live in Indiana, ironically, Dan Cannon running in Indiana.
Uh-huh.
So it was amazing to come from a very red state to kind of a purple state that went immediately red. After election in 2012, and just kind of have to fight this fight yet once again for better public schools and access to voting and all of that.
Right. You, Jenny Marshall, you have a great website. You know, one thing that Howie Klein is a regular on my program. He's on with us every Thursday. Uh-huh. And one thing that we've noted is the real progressive candidates are not afraid to put their stance on all the issues on their website. They want us to know where you stand on all the issues. And you have a very comprehensive website, not only where you stand on the issues, but all the information about early voting, where and when and all that. People can find at Marshall, M-A-R-S-H-A-L-L, marshallforhouse.org. So great work on the website. But where you stand on the issues. Healthcare is a big one. I'm a lung cancer survivor, and my insurance is through Obamacare. And I really worry, year to year, what's going to happen. They try as they might have to convince us that Obamacare is dead. It actually isn't, and I still have my insurance through it, although I don't know what the case is going to be next year. Where are you on healthcare? What's the future of healthcare in this country, or what should it be?
Well, it should be a single payer universal system. There are multiple models around in the European country, Canada, other industrialized nations have models where if you're sick, you can go to the doctor, you can get a prescription, and there's no out of pocket cost. You don't have to be afraid of the risk to your family and your family's finances to go get care. And I think that's what we need to move to. Not only health care, mental health care, dental care, vision care. I'm not sure exactly why at some point in time we decided our eyes and our teeth are different than the rest of our body. But I view this us as a whole, and we need to make sure that people have access to treatment before it becomes a serious problem. We know that in this country, the vast majority of bankruptcies are due to medical bills, and frankly, it's appalling, and we could do better.
Yeah, we're the only industrialized nation, the only modern democracy where you go bankrupt because you have medical bills. You put us up against the rest of the world, and it's astounding. Absolutely astounding.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and we're the type of industry, this for-profit healthcare industry, that you don't even know what it's going to cost you until you already have the procedure done.
Right.
So there's an interesting video that came out with, I think it was Vox, that put it out there that he was a soon-to-be dad. He was trying to get an idea of how much his wife's maternity costs were going to be. And it just takes you through the whole entire cycle of calling these hospitals. And they're like, well, sir, you'll have to wait for the bill to know how much it's going to cost. That is simply unacceptable. It's why we have people not getting the care that they need. And it's just something that needs to be changed. And that's an immediate thing that I would address in Congress as the representative from the 5th District is economic disparity and our health care system.
Great. Well, I've got time for one more question, and I guess today is 420, a day that a lot of marijuana users have glommed onto. What's your view on the future of legalized cannabis?
I think people have evolved on this issue. I've kind of always been here where we need to legalize it. We need to decriminalize it. We need to legalize it. We need to regulate it, sell it. And much like we do tobacco and alcohol, we need to make sure that we're not drug testing for it so that if you do smoke legal marijuana that you're not going to lose your job from it, that we need to make sure that those people who have been arrested and convicted on those crimes are appropriately dealt with, you know, expunge their records, you know, have some kind of release program. Because it's something that should not have been criminalized in the first place. It's tied to racism. And frankly, we need to just move on and, look at the research and, you know, have a better system of how we deal with, the marijuana, both CBD, medical marijuana, and just legalizing recreational marijuana.
Sounds good to me. Jenny Marshall for U.S. Congress from North Carolina's 5th Congressional District. Her website is marshallforhouse.org. Again, you can follow her on Twitter at Marshall4House. Jenny, it's great talking with you. Thanks for taking a few minutes out of poll working there to chat with us. Again, I think primaries are so important, and I want to let everyone know that North Carolina is coming up May 8th. Early voting is underway. Mm-hmm. And if you don't live in North Carolina, but you have friends who do, call and let them know. What is the 5th Congressional District? What towns, what cities are included in there?
Well, we only have one major city center. That's Winston-Salem. Uh-huh. We have Boone, which is in Watauga County, which has Appalachian State University. But basically, it's Forsyth County, Stokes County, and then just go to Tennessee. So there's a couple other counties in there. But it's really the biggest block of it is the top two counties from Stokes and Forsyth all the way across, including Alexander County, Avery County, and we have three precincts in Catawba County.
Wow. All right. Jenny Marshall, it was great talking with you. Thanks so much, and best of luck to you.
All right. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Uh-huh.
She does. She makes a lot of sense, right? All right. We're going to take a quick time out and come back on the other side with Dan Cannon of Indiana. Wait till you hear this guy. He's got one hell of a story to tell. Don't go away. I'm Nicole Sandler at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
These are the sounds of crushed souls, the sounds of despair from former radio personalities languishing in the purgatory of corporate consolidation. These former radio personalities have lost their livelihoods, not because they weren't entertaining or informative, but because they don't meet today's corporate terrestrial broadcast standards of being smelly, overweight douchebags, seething with vein-popping hatred. These radio refugees and their audiences have since migrated to the Internet, but their struggle continues as the quest for monetization ensues. Nicole Sandler is leading the way to reestablishing thought-provoking and entertaining radio, and you can help by clicking the donate button on NicoleSandler.com. Donate today, or as much and as often as you can. Dry the tears of listeners by removing the rotting stench of corporate radio. Won't you help?
All right, we're back. Nicole Sandler here at NicoleSandler.com and on the Progressive Voices Network. And I'm thrilled to welcome back to the show Dan Cannon. Dan, you there?
Hi, Nicole. How are you? Wow, the rotting stench of corporate radio. Is that what it is? So you don't pull any punches on this show, and that's what I like about it.
Yeah, well, neither do you. And your story is so great. We had the opportunity to speak a few months back. Howie Klein introduced us. And when he mentioned to me that your primary is then up next, he said, would you like to have Dan Cannon back on the show? I jumped at the chance because I think not only Indiana, but the country would be lucky to have you in Congress. So for those who didn't get to hear you, I want to reintroduce you to an audience who hopefully some of them at least either can vote in Indiana's 9th district or they know some people who live there who might be compelled to vote. And we need to do it now during primary season because this is when we can get you on the ballot. How big of a field is the primary?
No, go ahead.
How big of a
field? Yeah, and thank you. Yeah, thank you for all those kind words, and thank you for everything that you're doing, and thanks for having me back on. The primary is currently three people.
Okay.
So it's me and two people from Bloomington, which is sort of where we have typically generated candidates. I mean, Bloomington is sort of the progressive center of the district. And that's where Indiana University is. And then, of course, there's the whole rest of the district. There's a lot of ground outside of Bloomington, and that's where I grew up. I think it gives us a real advantage in the generals.
Great. And how about in the primary? How's you know, in talking to Howie, one thing I've learned this cycle more than some others in the past, the DCCC seems to be going out of its way to find candidates who are anything but progressive. Is that what we're up against here? I mean, you are, if you get Blue America's nod of endorsement, we know that you're a progressive, and as we'll get into a few of the issues here as time permits, listeners will hear that. What are your primary opponents like?
Yeah, you know, I think there's one that is, you know, I think a well-intentioned candidate that, you know, it just has not done any fundraising and has not been out there that much. You know, it's just somebody I think that wants to be on the ballot and to get and talk to people, which is fine. You know, my serious primary competition is a woman that moved from Washington, D.C. to the district, you know, for the first time in her adult life last July. And so it is, you know, the DCCC is not directly getting involved in this race at this point that we know of. But it is very much a, it's shaping up to be the sort of establishment DC candidate versus, you know, somebody who's been there his entire life, which is me.
And you have. Your story is a great one. You want to tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are now?
Sure. Yeah, I grew up, here in Southern Indiana. I was the son of a single mom, working class mom who worked, two or three jobs to, keep me well fed and well read and relatively well adjusted, I guess. And, you know, when I, after seeing her make all those sacrifices for her, you know, my entire life, I repaid all that, to my mother by dropping out of high school when I was 17. So she wasn't super happy with me over that, but I was a musician here in the district and that's what I was doing for, and I was just sort of, you know, intoxicated with that for a while, and playing all over the place, teaching guitar and doing that kind of thing. And so, you know, I got to know a lot of people, a lot of different kind of people, doing that, you know, growing up and doing that work, that I became really, really familiar with the people in Indiana and in the region. And what they were going through on a day-to-day basis. People want to talk to you, you know, when you're a musician, they want to talk to you on the set break, they want to connect with you. So I think I really learned to love the people in my community, doing that work. And, you know, eventually got my GED and I put myself through college, because I wanted to do something to give more back to my community. And I was casting about looking for ways to do that. The first person in my family to graduate from college. And so I did pretty good at that. And I think despite the fact that I don't think that I'd ever had a conversation with a lawyer when I got out of college. But by the time I got out of college, I went ahead and signed up for law school and went to do that. And not really thinking I was going to go out and practice or anything. But that's what I ended up doing. I ended up being a trial lawyer, civil rights lawyer in a small plaintiff's firm. And that's pretty much what I've done my whole career. So lots of employment discrimination, representing workers against big business, and sex discrimination cases, race discrimination cases, whistleblower cases, that kind of thing. And then that sort of parlayed itself into doing more what we call constitutional litigation. So police brutality cases, inmates' rights cases, and just all around constitutional type stuff. And you know, through having a history of doing that and having some fairly high profile cases, I ended up working on the marriage equality cases in both Indiana and Kentucky. And back a couple of years ago in 2015, the Kentucky case went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. Right. And that's a case your listeners might know by the name of Obergefell versus Hodges. And I ended up being lead counsel for the Kentucky plaintiffs in that case. And so that was, you know, obviously a big deal and a great big victory, and just a real honor and a privilege to be a part of. And then we went right from that to litigating the Kim Davis case, the clerk that wouldn't issue the marriage licenses out in Eastern Kentucky.
Yeah. We remember
her. We litigated against her, and that's still going on. And then something else that your listeners might know about is when a certain candidate was running for president of the United States. He made a stop in close to my hometown and invited a seething mob of white supremacists to beat up my black client who was there to peacefully protest. And that video went viral. It was all over the place. And we, you know, we took her case and sued the white supremacist and aforementioned candidate who shall remain nameless, but may or may not now be the leader of the free world, and his campaign. And so, you know, we've got a lot of high profile stuff. And after the 2016 elections, I think that I was looking for ways that I could do more. I mean, I think a lot of people are sort of in that mode, like, you know, looking around after Trump got elected and seeing what's happening to the country and say, all right, what can we do to sort of grab the reins here? And for me, this was something that I could do. I mean, I could, get into Congress and hopefully be a voice for a lot of people that have felt very disconnected from their government, from politics, from their democracy for a very long time. And so, having been through real problems that affect real people, both on my own and through my clients and through my family, I think that I have a unique understanding of the real problems that people are going through here on the ground in my district and how to come up with real solutions for those. So that's what I like to do in Congress.
Great. Now, who's in that seat now?
It's a guy named Joseph Albert Hollingsworth III.
Okay.
So somebody who had never set foot in Indiana before 2015, I don't think. So I'm a little bit resentful of that. Essentially this was a Republican that had a whole lot of money that decided he was going to buy a district somewhere and chose this one to buy.
Wow. And he's the incumbent. Is this his first term?
His first term. And he did, about 14 points. So our congressional candidate in 2016 did about 14 points better than Hillary. He's just not well liked even by Republicans on the ground here. I think he's very vulnerable, and I think they know that. So they're going to be putting a lot of resources into this race to try to keep that seat, along with Joe Donnelly's seat. Of course, we've got a Senate election here and a Democrat in the Senate, and so there's going to be a lot of GOP resources being thrown at Indiana this time around. So we really need all the help we can get. And I appreciate this signal boost.
Sure. Well, it's my pleasure. Dan Cannon again is with us. The website is cannonforindiana.com, and you're on Twitter at @cannonforindiana. What are the big issues that your constituents that they're interested in? I mean, I'm guessing healthcare is a big one.
Oh yeah. Healthcare is the one. I mean, to the extent that there's a universal issue in my district, it's healthcare. And the other one would be the opioid crisis, because there's not anybody in any part of the district that doesn't know somebody that has been touched by that. Everybody's got friends and family that have been touched by it, including me. And so, yeah, those are our big challenges, as far as messaging goes. And I think, we've got an obligation to go out and give people hope for the future of our district and the future of America, in that, we're going to have a healthcare system where people don't have to go bankrupt or die just because they can't pay a medical bill. And that we're going to, take some of these common sense approaches to moving the issue of addiction itself out of the criminal justice box and trying to put it in the public health box. And so those are our challenges, and they are district wide.
I'll ask you a question I asked Jenny Marshall a few minutes ago. Today is 4:20. What are your thoughts on legalization of marijuana? And I ask in this context because there are many who believe that cannabis use could help with the opioid crisis. It's a reliable painkiller in many ways and could help get people off of opioids.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, I support full legalization, and I have since day one of this campaign, and have been very outspoken about that. I have filed litigation over, in the past over medical cannabis and trying to get people access to medical cannabis, because I think it's ridiculous that they don't have that access. And you do see it fueling the opioid epidemic here, and I think that the data that we have on this bears it out. If you look at the other 29 states in the District of Columbia where there are meaningful provisions for the use of medical cannabis, you see overdoses go down sometimes by as much as 25% in some of these states.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes logical sense, because it's the only thing that you've got to prescribe people for chronic pain, which is how people get addicted to opioids by and large in the first place.
Right.
The only thing that you've got to prescribe them for chronic pain is opioids, which is the situation that doctors find themselves in Indiana and Kentucky and all over the region here. If we don't have provisions for medical marijuana, then, people end up addicted to opioids. They're taking fistfuls of these things, and they're getting prescribed fistfuls of these things. And pharmaceutical companies are putting huge amounts of these pills into the stream of commerce, knowing that people are going to take too many of them. And medical cannabis gives an alternative to, you know, it's funny that we still hear this myth of marijuana being this gateway drug to other things, which is just nonsense. And I mean, the reality of medical cannabis is that it's an exit drug. We see people able to treat chronic pain with something other than an opioid. And it's just a common sense solution to let people have whole plant medical marijuana. And I support it for responsible use purposes too. I mean, I think it's something that creates a whole new industry for Indiana that could be a very thriving industry that could bring a lot of revenue into the state, as we've seen in the example of Colorado. And there's no reason why we shouldn't be doing that in Indiana and nationwide.
I agree with you. And back to healthcare for a moment. You do support full on single payer universal healthcare for all. Yes.
Single payer, comprehensive, available to everyone and free at the point of service. I think that is the way we have to do it if we're going to have a real meaningful healthcare system that's going to ultimately reduce costs and save lots and lots of lives over the long run. I mean, it's ultimately the moral solution and economic solution that we need to be shooting for.
I'm looking at the priorities page of your website, canonforindiana.com, and you have one paragraph, demand comprehensive environmental protections, including but not limited to legislative strengthening of the EPA. How disgusted are you in watching what Scott Pruitt has done with the EPA so far?
Oh, extremely disgusted. But I mean, it is the theme of this administration, right? To install people who not only don't believe in the mission of the executive branch agency that they are heading up, but also think that the mission should be the opposite of what it's always been. Mm-hmm. So somehow here's a guy that seems to earnestly believe that the best thing that we can do with the Environmental Protection Agency is to protect the fossil fuel industry with it. I mean, it's absurd. And it's just, you know, it's cronyism. It's American oligarchy at its most disgusting. And it's, you know, we need to call it out. And Congress needs to take a role in holding these guys accountable for their actions and for their inactions and heading up these executive branch agencies, because ultimately we can talk about policy and good legislation and the Paris Accords and all that stuff for, you know, that we could do for the environment. We could talk about that stuff all day long. But if we don't have a functioning EPA and we don't have anybody in Congress holding this executive branch accountable for maintaining the dysfunction of the EPA, then it's really not going to do us much good. We're not going to get anywhere on these environmental issues that are really, really critical to the people in my district and the people, frankly, all over the world.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, we pulled out of the Paris Accord. We've got this Sunday is Earth Day, and it's embarrassing what our nation is doing or not doing to combat climate change.
Yeah, absolutely.
Today happens to be the 19th anniversary of the Columbine shooting, and students around the country walked out of their classrooms again today. Indiana, I'm guessing, is more of a gun state than many. What are your thoughts on gun violence?
Well, this is another one of those things where I think my state has an undeserved reputation. And it has a lot to do with the people that we elect to represent us. Unfortunately, this is not something that's unique to Indiana. But we've got elected officials that, you know, if you talk to people on the ground about common sense gun legislation, universal background checks, you know, for example, banning bump stocks, not selling guns to people who've been convicted of domestic violence, waiting periods, things like that, right? People by and large agree with that stuff. You've got huge bipartisan agreements among working class people, like people that those laws would affect on the ground in places like Indiana or any place else that's a quote unquote gun state, right? Where you have the disconnect is you have elected officials that are being bought and paid for by, you know, by the NRA and other mouthpieces for gun manufacturers, basically. And, you know, that's something that we need to call out, and we need to have these conversations on the ground and say, when do you support this and when do you support that? And we're not really coming to take away all your guns.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to have those conversations face to face and humanize ourselves as much as we possibly can. But, you know, it's clear that we've got to do something about this. And I think that by and large, ordinary people, you know, regular folks in my district realize that we have to do something. And, you know, if we're in a trial and error period for a little while, then so be it. But we need to figure out what the root causes of gun violence in America are. We need to figure out a meaningful way to get to those solutions, and then we need to be enacting those solutions. And in the meantime, I mean, I think that we've got to try anything and everything that's going to, you know, if we think that we can implement a policy that's going to save even a single kid's life.
Yeah, we got to do it. Dan Cannon, we're out of time. Thank you so much. Dan Cannon.
Thanks so much, Nicole.
CannonForIndiana.com is where we find him. And thank you again, and best of luck on May 8th.